Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
James, I'm an alcoholic. My story is not as boring as that history was.
Jeez.
Actually, Dry Diggins is a really good meeting. I hope you guys can come out and join us. A lot of great sobriety there. I have a home group. It's a Dry Diggins group. I have a sobriety date. It's December the 6th, 1982. Sponsor, his name is Jack. Sobriety date is when I last smoked marijuana. I was smoking marijuana so I wouldn't drink. Maybe you tried that. Worked pretty good for a while. Didn't drink. The reason I was smoking marijuana not to drink is that I had a problem with drinking. And clearly see that alcohol was causing me problems, like I was going to jail a lot. And I didn't want to go to jail anymore. And I knew that if I was going to drink that I couldn't control it. I understood that part about it. When I started, I had no idea. I couldn't predict what was going to happen. It wasn't good, but I couldn't with any assurity know where I was going to end up at any given time. So I quit drinking. I made a decision to quit drinking. Like I'd made thousands of times before, but this time it happened to stick. And I had a little patch of marijuana growing in my backyard out in Lincoln. So I smoked marijuana. It just seemed like a good idea to me. Did that for 3 years. I came to AA 3 years after my last drink. Because I realized in that three-year period that my problem was just more than not drinking. The problem was something called alcoholism. Just not drinking doesn't solve my problem. I need to treat my alcoholism. And I was treating it with marijuana. And it didn't work. And in that three-year period, my sister was going to AA. And every time I'd see her, I'd get the Visine out and, try to clear my eyes up and I'd go see her. And her life was getting better, and my life wasn't getting better. I got here, I had a lot of resistance because I hadn't had a drink for 3 years. I had a real hard time thinking I was alcoholic because I hadn't been drinking. I didn't want to be alcoholic. My God, my dad was an alcoholic. I didn't want to be like him. But I knew there was something wrong with me in the insides. And I hung around the meetings trying to get a grasp of this thing. And I'm so happy that in the meetings I went to in Auburn and Roseville, there was a sign on the wall that it said the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And I had that. I didn't want to drink. And I knew that marijuana counted. So I was clean and sober. But I didn't identify myself as alcoholic. And if there had been a requirement for me to say that I had to say I was alcoholic when I came in, I would have had to leave. If there had been another sign that said that I had to believe in God, I would have left. Another sign that said I had to work the steps, I would have left. I wasn't able to do any of those things when I got here. But I saw another sign that said, keep coming back, we care. And I kept coming back. And very slowly, over a period of time, I'd say it took me 6 months, I finally realized that I was alcoholic. I mean, I'm not very quick. I was sitting in meetings for 6 months, and finally I raised my hand when they said, I'm alcoholic. So what happened to me is it's a contagious disease. And I caught it in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you're here tonight and you're not alcoholic, I'd warn you, this is very contagious stuff. And you might get it if you hang around us. Because I hung around, but I had drank alcoholically for, 20, 30 years. I was an alcoholic drinker out of the gate. I was a very late starter. I probably didn't start till I was about 20. I drank very alcoholic. I mean, I blacked out a lot right off the bat. You could tell me something about what I did or didn't do when I was drinking, and I couldn't deny it or confirm it because I didn't know. I heard a story that kind of pretty much summarized my drinking. I like drinking in bars. I grew up in L.A. and went to school there, and I moved to Europe. I did a junior year in Heidelberg, and I went back to Europe after I graduated from college and spent a couple of years kind of wandering around in Amsterdam and Heidelberg and Munich and a lot of places like that. And had a pretty, what looked like on the outside, a pretty romantic kind of life, but I was very empty on the inside. My drinking kind of, I heard a story about a guy who drank in L.A. and blackout drinker, and he went to a really nice bar one night, nice band and pretty girls, and bartender poured double shots, and they had, it was a really classy place, they had gold toilets, and he passed out, threw up, whatever. The next night he couldn't remember where he'd been, but he wanted to find this place again because he liked it so much, and he set out to find this bar, and the only thing he could remember about it was that the bar where he was sitting had blue wallpaper in the back where the bottles were. And every night he went out looking for this bar. And about a month later, he was in a place. The ladies didn't look too good, but it was early. And there was a band kind of starting up over on the side. And he could kind of recognize this blue wallpaper. And he asked the bartender, he said, you know, a few weeks back I was out drinking, and I had a heck of a good time. And I think I was in this bar. And, you know, could you tell me, do you have gold toilets? And the bartender shouts out to the guy in the band, we found the guy that puked in your tuba. That's kind of the way I drank. I want to say a couple of things for Jeremy. I'm really glad that you're here tonight, Jeremy. You've probably paid a pretty high price to get here, like most of us have. It's a very expensive club we join. We pay with our lives. And it's a gift we get, sobriety. But we pay a price for sobriety, too, and we work the steps. The steps are the price that I pay to stay. And I belong to a group of guys that we work with every week. We get together, and we're on step 9 right now. Every Saturday, we work the steps together. And, I had a lot of resistance to that. I studied philosophy in college, and I wanted to figure things out. And there's not a chapter called Figure It Out. There's not a chapter called Into Thinking. It's called Into Action. And I had to take action. I read a quote by Einstein a couple of days ago that I liked a lot. It was, the predominant problems of your life cannot be solved with the thinking that created them. I had to get outside of the thinking that I was thinking, because my thinking was broken. I love sitting on bar stools and thinking and drinking. It never changed. I had to get to AA, and I had to start taking action. The action that I took was very contrary to my nature. I went and saw a guy around 6 months of sobriety, and I poured my heart out to him because I didn't have a sponsor, I didn't have a God. I paid this guy $50 to sit in his office for an hour, and I cried, snot running down my face. And it was a $50 fifth step, is what it's called. And he wrote on a piece of paper, get on your knees and pray. And I started to do that, maybe because I wanted to get my money's worth. I don't know why I did. I didn't even believe in God. But I started to take the action, and my life started to get better. And I started to use the group, the power of the group. I'd look around the meetings, and there'd be a lot of people who had a lot of sobriety, and I believed them that they had something that I didn't have. I started being willing to change. In the process of taking the action, my life started to change, and I ended up finding a power in my life that worked really well. And it's a power greater than I am, and it's a power that I rely on. I needed a power greater than the power of alcohol. Alcohol was the most powerful thing in my life. And I found a power greater than the power of alcohol. It's called Alcoholics Anonymous. The process of allowing you into my life, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. If I'd had a book and been put on a rock someplace, I would have died. I needed you people. My God had skin on him. And the people came to me, and they helped me, and they still help me, and they rally around me, and show me that I belong, and that I have a place to go. And I was a misfit all my life. I love being a part of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I met a woman in AA, and I got married. I was a 40-year-old bachelor when I got here, and my wife has 18 years of sobriety. I have 18. She has a son who's my son now too, and he has 13 years of sobriety. He married a girl who got sober when she was 16, and she has 13 years of sobriety. Her has 20 years of sobriety. Her husband has 22 years of sobriety. And their daughter has 10 years of sobriety. So, Alcoholics Anonymous works. Thank you.
Thank you, James. And tonight our main speaker is Scott M. from Dixon.
Hoping there's a break because I really got to pee. My name's Scott. I'm an alcoholic. thing at the back table. I picked it up. One of the things Bill Wilson always said, one of the prominent conditions of alcoholism is emotional immaturity, and they have a little pamphlet if you're interested in it. I was reading it. I got a long way to go, but something jumped out at me, and see if you can see a thread inside of this. He accepts criticism gratefully. He does not indulge in self-pity. He does not expect special consideration from anyone. He controls his temper. He meets emergencies with poise. His feelings are not easily hurt. He accepts responsibilities of his own and acts without trying to alibi. He has outgrown the all or nothing. He is. You see that he's always saying he. There's nothing about she in here. Also, as I read this, I find out I don't have much emotional maturity. I'd like to welcome the newcomers to Alcoholics Anonymous. Having to come up and stand in front of a bunch of people when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my very first meeting was at a group called the El Cerrito Fellowship. And when I walked in there after what it takes to get us to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, that arrogance and bravado that I still am trying to shake was, there was a gentleman who had urinated on himself standing in one corner. Another lady was talking to herself in a chair. None of the chairs matched. The carpet had stains on it, and I said I wouldn't even drink in a place like that. No, and that's how I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was May 29th, 1987. And I don't know if I heard something or was just desperate enough, well, maybe there's got to be a little bit more, and I found out about another group, and I went to it, and I heard about a new group that was opening up, the Elsa Brandy Fellowship, and I went there, and I love... when you're sharing that, alternatives to drinking. I came to the El Cerrito Fellowship. I got a gentleman to be my sponsor. Matter of fact, I think he lives in Grass Valley or Auburn now. His name's Phil R. And I got a big book, read it, memorized the squiggly writing, and we got into service. It was a Monday noon secretary. But every 3 weeks, I'd go out and get a gram of cocaine and sit in my little 600-square-foot apartment and watch pornography. And... for 9 months, I did that, and I'd leave the meeting, go do that for whatever time it took, and I'd come back the following Monday, and nobody knew. But nothing changed, except that I found a way to live with myself for the time being, without God and without having worked the steps. And I went back to this doctor who suggested I go to Alcoholics Anonymous and said Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't working. And the miracle of that was he... the next day, and that was February 17th, 1988. And that was the last time, and for me, my sobriety started the last time I put cocaine in me. The next day, he put me in a 28-day treatment program on the third floor of Alta Bates Hospital in Berkeley. Thought, you know, they'd give me the secret so I could live my life successfully, and all they did was drive us around to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, Narcotics Anonymous meetings, and H and I came in, and Wendy? What was her name, Wendy? Warren. God, it's amazing. 13 years, I still remember Wendy and Warren. They'd come in and they'd have their book and we'd talk about the first three steps. You know, that 9 months, that's as good as it's going to get, what I had done for 9 months. Except I was going to have to do it without the cocaine therapy. And I found out last year... I'm not saying this to boast, because actually all of our lineage goes back to two people. There was a gentleman named Bill W. who sponsored a man named Mac, and nobody knew Mac's name, I found out. I didn't even know that it went back. And Mac sponsored a guy named Jim Masterson. And Jim sponsored a guy named Bob. And Bob sponsored a guy named Art, and Art's my sponsor. I've had seven sponsors, I'll tell you that too. The first, was it six months of sobriety, I had four sponsors. The very first guy I asked to be my sponsor, I've never seen again. The second guy I asked to be my sponsor was 5 years sober, and he drank. And I was starting to think I was a little bit powerful in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was just scaring him away. And Phil ended up being my third sponsor, and somebody I didn't do my fifth step with. Coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean, I heard that, and I'll share with you The reason why is I heard a guy had come to him and told him something confidential, and I heard him sharing in jest who that person was and what he shared with him at a meeting, coffee room, and I could not share this man my life story. Back to him, he's very instrumental in helping keep me sober. And I'll share with you. Welcome to the real Linda contingent. I grew up in a little town called El Sobrania. Matter of fact, next month the speaker, Mark S., who was one of those men who surrounded me when I got sober, will be speaking here. Phenomenal man to me. Might bore the crap out of you. But he's always been somebody who's made me think, challenge that thinking. You know, in El Sobrania, it's kind of like what Dixon's actually bigger than the town I grew up in, what I thought it was. It's a suburb. I actually grew up in Richmond. I always thought I lived in El Sobrania, just the way it's annexed. I live right in the heart of El Sobrania, but it's actually Richmond. And it's like a Leave It to Beaver. I used to catch polywogs and drive a stingray around in town. It was just wonderful. Thanksgiving and Christmas, my relatives would dress like this and in sweaters, and they'd sit and watch football games, and somebody would score a touchdown, and they'd woo, you know, and they'd go back to it. And my parents, they had this liquor cabinet, and the only liquor only came out. There was no locks on it. Didn't need it for me. Not at that time, but the only time that liquor would come down was Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. And they'd use a jigger to pour the shots. And they'd use the line. You know, and pour the shot. And I always thought that was funny. Let me see one hand. Did anybody drink in a bar, if you did drink in a bar, where they've used a jigger? Person. You're not an alcoholic. No. I drank in bars. I looked for them. I like... That's how they poured them, at the M&M, at Hanno's, at the Rancho Bar, at Ed's Bar. They didn't use jiggers. My parents used a jigger. And now my parents aren't alcoholic. And I came a lot of the stuff I had to get through when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it seemed when I came there was some criteria, not only just in my life. It seemed most people came from an alcoholic home. Neither of my parents were alcoholics. Seemed to have come from an abused home. I didn't consider myself abused. I did things that deserved to get my ass whipped. And 502s. Phil had 13 502s. 13 drunk drivings. I never had one. And I just really found it, you know, a hard time. I was 4.5 years sober. I love it, Bridget. I'm sorry, I just skipped my name, the 10-minute speaker. I think you talk about coming to, because of the insanity and coming and figuring it 6 months before you figure I was an alcoholic. I was 4.5 years sober because I thought I was just a cocaine addict. And I'd keep my sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous to find that, and thank you, that phenomenon of craving. And I was doing H&I work when I found that out. It took a while for me to figure out, if you're snorting a lot of cocaine, you're not going to black out or get a 502 because you drive pretty good, even though you're 3 sheets to the wind. And I was nothing. Blackouts. I heard about blackouts coming. I never had a blackout. And at least I thought, couldn't remember. My blackouts were such, I found out about 2 since being sober, but they weren't common occurrences. So it was real hard. I think grace or a miracle, whatever, that the fact that I'm standing here today 4,757 days sober, because the odds are against us. I'm not going to say they're against me. Also, a lot of the people in this room I know who've been sober for a long time are buried people who were members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they died drunk. Buried family members. Started after about 7 years. I didn't take it so casually anymore. Growing up in this little town of El Sobrania, looking back on it, an unexamined life is not worth living. I think it was Aristotle who said that. It took me a lot. The more I was pushed into society. Grade school, I fit in. Didn't have much problems. Seemed like I got in more fights than most people. Got my feelings hurt and had to defend them. But in the more junior high, especially when you start getting into your sexuality, and I'm scared to death of women. I still am, and even my wife, I'm scared of her. I am. I'm not trying to be funny. It's just afraid. It's just that. I mean, someday maybe I'll get over it. Someday maybe I won't. But that wanting, I was a virgin until I was 24, and now a lot of times when I went on a drink, I thought tonight would be the night I'll lose it, you know. But by the time I could talk, by the time I could actually go up and approach a woman, I couldn't talk, and I was actually almost couldn't even walk. And so it's a wonder that even anybody would hang around me. But it's, and in high school, it just seems the more I was crunched into society, selfishness, self-centeredness. I always knew people were talking about me. I always knew I didn't fit in. I was inadequate. Men were better looking than me. Women weren't looking at me. I was a skinny kid. To give you the contrast of what alcohol did for me, James is talking about how powerful alcohol was. I hated, and I'm sure all men in here, if you had PE, there was skins and shirts if you played basketball, and I hated to be on the skins because I had to take my shirt off, and I always knew I was a skinny. Nobody cared. Nobody, let's see how Scott looks like when he takes his shirt off. But that's what I thought. That's how my head works. Everybody's always interested in me. But a couple of years after I started my drinking, after a night of drink, I believe it was Bacardi 151, streaking was big in the 70s, butt naked, no mask, right down the middle of the football field. And that's what alcohol did for me. It allowed me to do, for me, what I could not do for myself. And I wasn't ashamed the next day. I love attention, but I hate it when people are looking at me. Relate with that. I loved walking down the halls at school after I've driven my motorcycle into somebody's house during a party or rearranged their furniture, streaked butt naked down the football field, and people going, "Scott, hey, how you doing?" And I didn't even have an idea who they were or why they knew me. It's just because I kind of got that notoriety, the class clown, the guy who was crazy on the edge. It just, and I loved that attention. I loved that attention. Marvelous times. Also seems I to this day I still feel sad who drank people who drank alcoholically from the start. I didn't. I drink myself. I consider I'm one of those who drink myself into alcoholism. I've also just celebrated 13 years and I've been sober now as long as I drank. The first 7 years of my drinking was absolutely positively phenomenally fun. I don't hang in there for 6 years of hell because there wasn't any fun to recollect in there. The things I did, I just recently, last weekend as a matter of fact, went up to, my wife took me to Reno for my birthday, and it was the first time I've skied in 13 years. That was something else, because one thing that takes away fear is booze. The thing that takes away the feeling of inadequacy and if people think I'm not dressed right or my skis aren't new enough I know people are looking at the way I ski. There must be 600 people on the slopes, and I feel they're all riding up the lift looking at me. God, Scott still can't ski. And that's that selfishness, that self-centeredness. And I still deal with that. Nobody came to ski to see how I'm dressed or how my style is, if my style has the flu or not. Nobody cares. I care deeply. I've changed my shirt 3 times tonight before I came here and wanted to try on another jacket because I think you're going to be impressed with how I dress. Nobody, when you leave here, is going to remember what the hell I wore. And it's taken me time to really work through this. Just throw on what you like. And I remember one of my sponsors along the way, he dressed, Tony could dress sharp. He dressed like a pimp. He was sharp, and I remember driving with Tony one time. I said, "God, Tony, I want to be like you. I want to dress like you." And he said something very profound for me. And it stuck. My whole life, I've always tried to be like you. I thought you would want me to be. Alcohol took away those feelings where I didn't care. Too bad you don't look like me. Too bad you don't feel like me. Too bad you're not as smart as me. Yeah, it's just that's what the drinking did. Allowed me to live. I'm getting old too. Nobody talks about getting old in Alcoholics Anonymous. Since 40, I'm 42, and I swear to God, Bette Midler says it great. After the age of 40, the body gets a mind of its own. I'm losing my eyesight. I'm gonna have to get bifocals soon. I have to get big glasses so I can have the two lenses. Memory. I'm losing. I'm lucky I can remember my wife's name or my dog's name. You ever, I'm walking into rooms. I feel like a dog. You walk into a room, you don't know why you're there. And now this is more information than you need, but I'm getting hair on parts of my body I never had hair before. And I'm having to do this sober. And it's frustrating to me. I mean, again, I never heard people talk about this. They got issues, but, you know, I mean, this is things, it's like... hairs out of my nose. I mean, I clipped a hair today. It was almost as long as my mustache hair out of my nose. And again, for somebody who's consumed with how they look, because you're looking at me, you know, I'm thinking, God, I'm glad I caught that before I got up there and spoke. Like, you're going to see a nose hair from way back where you are. But... sure, laugh. This is serious stuff for me. I deal with this on a daily basis. Not the nose hair thing before all that. One thing I forgot when I do, Arthur, it's good to see you too. I want to jump around a lot for all of you here. You know, I was outside. Lenny was walking up. Lenny, I'm blessed to have this woman in my life. I mean, great example of Alcoholics Anonymous. She's a great example of sobriety. And like, there was the real Linda people were out there. And she goes, let's go up and say hi. See, I'm like, man, I mean, I don't say that. I think that. And, you know, she goes up and I hear Ed and Ed and Troy and Rocky and Deborah. And, you know, I can remember names. See, maybe my Alzheimer's not that bad yet. And I just sat there and watched her go around and introduce. Like, I wish I could do that. Going. See, there's the thing. I just slipped what the hell I mentioned. All that crap. Why did I do that? Die sober, if I can remember I was sober. I walked up and Rick was out there and I said, that's what made me think of that incident. I said, you know, fellowship's really overrated. And because I found in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thought, here is a secret. When I started to read this, it says there is a substitute for drinking and it's the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think, God, I was such a letdown. Because that emotional immaturity, I have social retardation. I mean, sometimes, again, to stand up, walk up, and it's just part of me to walk up and tell people, you know, I really wish there was a break, I got to pee, and then nobody laughs and you think, there he is. I haven't grown up enough, I'm not slick enough, I'm not smooth enough. It's just that, but you know what? Basically, is sticking with the deal for this long as I'm starting to become comfortable with being social retarded. And it does, and I don't do it so much. I used to embarrass, you know, Lenny would scatter, you know, I mean, I would say things as in front of her in public. I'd say things about her, and that's where I found out I needed Al-Anon at 9 years. Well, here's a joke. I'll give you a joke if you want to hear it or not. What is this? An Al-Anon sharpening their tongue. And there's, okay, it's not that. Told the same joke for the PTA, it went over very big. When I was 19, my dad got me a job. I worked for the San Francisco Chronicle. I've been with them for 22 years. Been a foreman for 18 of those years. And I was living at home. My dad, I started working there when I was 19. And I was living at home, making as much money as my dad, not paying rent, not buying food, not doing my laundry, not helping out around the house. I had a brand new Toyota 4x4 lift kit, all the amenities, stereo, and I was dealing drugs at work and drinking. I have enough drugs hidden underneath the ashtray for me and to sell. Well, for me to do for free and to sell to make that profit, and an open can of beer driving across the San Francisco Bay Bridge at nightfall, and the stereo blaring, I thought, you know, life just don't get any better. And it was awesome to be part of the After Hours Bar Club, you know, for any of those, again, that money, property, prestige to walk, you know, to go up.
Scott. Have people being a drug dealer at work, having people come. I was the youngest crane driver, youngest foreman, youngest man in charge, and they'd take the guy out of the crane out there because I could drive it. The booze took away fear of heights, and the cocaine made me sharp as a tack, and I could drop that newsprint faster than anybody, and we'd get down to the bar. So we'd work for an hour, get down to the bar for a half hour, come back, work for an hour, get down to the bar for a half hour. And man, it was awesome times. I did that from the time I was 19 till I was 23 years old. And I was outside the crane room one time with an open beer and chopping up my lines so I could do what I had to do on my coffee break. And and nobody, I don't know anybody drink coffee on coffee breaks that I work with. And, this guy came up and I offered him some of my finest, and he declined both. And he started talking to me, and this was 1982, around October, November of 1982. He sat there and talked to me for about a half hour. His name's Tom Neary, and I was his boss at one time. He's my supervisor now, but Tommy was sober. And he sat there, and I didn't know what he was doing, but for those in the know, he was 12-stepping me. He was telling me about his life, and it was a long time since I'd cried in public or in front of another man besides my dad, and I was crying within about 20, 30 minutes. Story was sad. Tommy was a little guy, and his belt buckle was about half the size of him. He said he'd walk into bars and not pick a fight with the biggest guy, but with the two biggest guys. Always walked in looking like John Wayne, but he felt like Shirley Temple, and I knew exactly what he was talking about. I knew exactly what he was talking about. And he said, and what made him do that, what took away Shirley? That's when I started, you know, those feelings of alcoholism. I haven't had a drink in 13 years, but I still have the disease of alcoholism. It's not alcoholism. Now, Tommy hand wrote the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous for me that night. And I wish I could pull that out, tattered piece of paper out of my wallet and unfold it about four times and show you that list. But I looked at it. I mean, I'm not an avid reader, but there was something quite philosophical, and sure, and I looked at it a couple times, and but I'm not that bad, you know. And but what I figured out that night, having to examine my life and look back at it, that it says in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, is an alcoholic is a person who's lost the ability to control and enjoy his drinking. What I started to do from that moment, 1982, was try to control and enjoy my drinking. Now, if you're new here and you want to test it. If you're an alcoholic like me, that's Bill Wilson didn't know enough about it back then, but it's true today. He says alcoholics of our type. Fundamentally, you're bad enough. You got to work these steps or die. What I found out was if I was controlling it, and I could, enjoying it, I wasn't controlling it. Now I was sober a long time before I went back and looked at that's what I did from 1982 to 1987 when I stopped drinking, that I was trying to control and enjoy my drinking. Now, I don't have to bring my car under control if it's not out of control. Obviously, if I'm trying to control and enjoy something, it's already out of control. Some of you are talking about being a little slow. You know, it took me a while to figure that one out. And and from 1982 till 1987, they weren't fun years. But I thought, the turning point, it wasn't a decision made on my point. Tommy, I like a lot of stuff about astronomy. You know, like these satellites we've sent into space, do they get close enough to planet? Matter of fact, they'll use the planet's gravitational pull to alter the course of the satellite. And what Tommy did by coming into my life like he did, he altered the course of my life. I called him up, I think I was about 2 years sober, and I called him up and thanked him for ruining my life. I didn't look at it then because they somebody else mentioned it tonight too, that you know that you can catch it. You know, you'll catch it if you come around your life. It'll definitely ruin your drinking if you're an alcoholic. And that's what Tommy did for me that night. Basically, from where I was, I call living life large, having fun, drinking every day, which I come to find out in here we call maintenance drinking. just, I'd wake up, I lived, you know, like I said, I was living at home, and I'd have a six-pack on the side of my waterbed, and I'd lean over there. And I wouldn't consciously think about it. I mean, if it was all right, you just walk out. Hi, Mom. Good morning, Dad. You know, but I'd open it up, put all the covers up, and it was like disarming a grenade. You know, it's that... You know, open it up so nobody can hear it. Well, obviously, if I'm hiding it, there's something wrong. I didn't dawn on me. I just hid it. Protection at all cost. But met a lady at around that time, man, who had to be really sick because here I was at the epitome of my disease, and she fell in love with me. And I went to getting in that relationship. Getting married probably for all the wrong reasons, and I left my job. This is the first time I took a job I thought I'd do. What I come to find, they talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous is a geographic. I was carrying guns and a lot of money at work, and I thought, you know, I need to get out of here. This lady loves me and scares her, and I want to take, they opened up a new satellite plant in Union City, and I thought I'd take a job down there and just get away from this. And I did. And I went from more drinking and using every day to about every other day to once a week, 2 weeks. And I don't know how long, maybe a year, year and a half, 2 years. It was about every 3 weeks. And I didn't know it. Again, looking back and examining my life, the jingles, for all you do, this bud's for you. And weekends were made for Michelob. And here's, tonight is something special. The beer you pour must be something. I mean, I would utilize these things to do what I had to do. I needed justification, and I knew it was no denial. And what I knew what I was going to do and what was going to happen. Illusional to think that it was going to be permanent. If I could just hook myself up to a Budweiser drip and powder my nose every half hour, I'd be fine. I'd probably be a fine human being if there was no consequences of the hangover. The hangovers weren't so damn funny the last 3 years. But 1985, that's when I got married, and really having to get underground, really having to hide this stuff. Now that really ruins your drinking, getting married, and they don't know what you're doing. Really having to get covert. And what I would do in those 3 weeks again is I would go back a beer, about a half a gram of cocaine, about two or three of my favorite pornos down at the store, and I'd come home. And I had a perfect marriage. My wife worked days and I worked nights. And I'm not saying that. I mean, it was perfect for me because she'd leave in the morning and I never fell asleep. I just couldn't wait for her to leave. And I'd bust out, pop in a tape, pop open a beer and start. And I'd pretend I was Hugh Hefner for about 48 hours. Again, I'm not funny. That was me to deal with my inadequacies. That it was party time. The girls were coming over. It was my little sick fantasies in my little 600 square foot apartment thinking I'm Hugh Hefner at the mansion. But it made it all right for me. I remember the gentleman down south named Johnny saying, you know, thank God for alcohol because it kept me from blowing my brain. The last 3 years, the last 2 years was really, I mean, I called it the Bermuda Triangle. It was hell. I knew exactly what was going to happen to me when I started. And I'd tell myself, I don't want to do this. I had no other options. I had no other alternatives. I was going around picking up what I needed to do to live as an alcoholic. I knew what was going to happen to me, what I was going to look like, feel like, my financial condition, my emotional, mental, and physical state. I knew I was going to miss some work, and I had no other way to get out of it. I couldn't wait to do it, and I was dreading having to do it. It was that way every 3 weeks for 2 years. Doctor, I don't know how that works out. I had a physical, and I decided to go on one of my binges 2 days before the physical. That was BS. I didn't decide. Got eyes pale, dehydrated, booze on my breath. I had an excuse for everyone, and I told him, I said, you know, I think I got a cocaine problem. He says, why don't you try Alcoholics Anonymous? And that's what I mentioned earlier.
And I went and I found that El Sobrini Fellowship in 9 months after quitting drinking. I went back to the doctor and said Alcoholics Anonymous didn't work. And really what I know now is I wasn't working Alcoholics Anonymous. Big difference. Thank Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember my brother, I thought it was a compliment, but I think he was slapped. He was really dissing me. I remember I said something at a meeting, and the place erupted in applause. He leaned over and he goes, "You're good." And I think it was like, you know, you're so full of crap. You got them, you know, blown, thinking that you're somebody. But I thought he was saying I was good, like I knew it, because I could recite the big book. I was in service, but I couldn't stay sober. I had a sponsor, and he wasn't calling me because I didn't have what he wanted. But and it damn near killed me. February 17th, 1988, 28 days, third floor, Alta Bates Hospital. It's kind of funny what Arthur said, too. You know, we call him. You know, we have a nice name for him now. You're committing yourself. And funny how those little cameras, and they're watching you. I got out of there, and I'll just briefly, for 2 years, all I did was go home, go to work, go to meetings, go home. Try to be a good husband, try to be a good son. Boss. I wasn't even trying to be a good driver. Wasn't even in my etiquette at that time. It wasn't important. Couldn't see it. Me and my wife had a little altercation. We'd slowly grown apart. And it was 2 days after Christmas, 1989. And I said, you know, I'm getting kind of getting tired of living like this. Married. And she says, I don't know. And I says, well, I'd like an answer in about 48 hours. And she gave me an answer in about 4 minutes. She wanted a divorce. And that's where I kind of started. I didn't know it then, but found out about alcoholism because there was no emotional support either side in the marriage. And I went in the bathroom. This is how I am. See, I go walk over real stylishly to the bathroom, close the door, lock it, and I got down on my hands and knees. Now, I didn't get any hugs for 2 years, but see, now I needed help again. It was always something for her to help when I was drinking and using, somebody to have the upper hand on. Upper hand to be had, and that was painful. And I had a biopsy. I had something on my leg. 2 days after that, it was one day before New Year's, 1989, I believe. A doctor called me in his office in Berkeley, and I thought it was funny why he needed to call me. He couldn't just tell me over the phone I was diagnosed with terminal cancer and given 6 months to live. Now, if you ever saw the movie Forrest Gump, Lieutenant Dan's in the rigging of the ship, cussing at God during the storm. He's a little pissed off for losing his legs. Here I was, in Alcoholics Anonymous, 2 years sober. Everybody lost their family, their wives, their credibility when they're out there drinking. Here I am, 2 years sober. My wife decides to leave me, and I'm dying in 6 months. I was a little pissed off at God. Prayer, which I've come to find out, this is not the prayer I learned in Sunday school. One of my parents forced me to go to church when I was a kid. And I can't, but it was an honest prayer. And I think honest prayers for me today are more important than the eloquent. I honestly believe that when I got sober, that that surrender to alcohol was so done. That I absolutely positively, I didn't have enough philosophy to understand. I just gave God my will and my life here. I've screwed it up bad enough. I've had to sit in the third floor of a hospital for 28 days. I have to go to a man's house and read this blue book. We only have one up here. I've read one of those damn blue books. It's written 1939. I have to sit in those meetings and listen to somebody read How It Works one more time. I'm condemned to this. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, the phony applause, the phony shares, and it was just, you know, that was my thinking, and it's, I was done. I won't say the poem, but there was a poem I read then, and the last two phrases on it, though I will say, it says that I'm the master of my fate, I'm the captain of my soul. One thing I believe, honestly, on that day, on that prayer, was God gave me my will and my life back because I had achieved some point of emotional maturity, some point of being
credible, respectable again. Here's your life back. Live it. And I can't say it wasn't written. One like what Tommy gave me is something I felt, something I know. God's never lived my life for me since. Sucks. I like to have somebody to blame along the way when things screw up. It's all in my lap. That was my spiritual immaturity. I always looked at God as a Santa Claus or a security guard. You know, I'll talk to him when I want something, and I'll call him when I need help. Got let down a lot. I got empowered with that the next day in the mail, and this is how I think. Spiritual awakening. I've had a lot of spiritual experiences. I think spiritual awakening, and I love what the big book says, is just a fundamental thing. Started to see I handled things differently, but the next day I got a brochure in the mail that talked about Seven Summit Club, climbing the seven highest mountains in the seven continents. Say this, going back to that May 29th, May 30th was the very first day I went backpacking, and I don't recommend going backpacking hungover. Before I was 2 years sober, I had gone over three of the highest passes in the Sierras, and I'd read this pamphlet said that they believe personal growth demands that you leave your comfortable, familiar, and predictable realm. The thing I've tried to do my whole life is be predictable. Now, if Alex has asked me to do it, step outside. And I go, Saturday. You know, that's my thought. Again, I've heard that too in Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes I don't walk my talk in Alcoholics Anonymous, and thank God I don't walk my think. Sometimes I can keep a rein back on that. I've learned some social skills. Before I was 4 years sober, I had also gone, within that 2 year period, I'd done five Class 5 rock climbs. And before I was 4 years sober, I'd stood on top of three summits in the Himalayas. And I thought, here's that thing again. My life don't get it. Money, property, prestige, having recognition. I was now, you know, we have Quiet Mark and Steamboat Rod and, I don't know, Crazy Linda. But, you know, because we don't have any last names. So you're kind of anonymous and humble and Alcoholics Anonymous. But I was the mountain climber Scott. Now I was a little different. Now I had, you know, I was out of that. And I was just this crazy guy again. And I think I loved that attention, that notoriety. And I don't know why, but I honestly thought, not being funny, I honestly thought, because I'd been sponsoring people for a couple of years at that time, and I thought I could heal people by like touching them, you know, and taking them to showing them the exact phrase they needed in the book. And it was powerful. Between 2 and 4 years of sobriety was a powerful period of my sobriety. And scared a lot of people. They thought I was just too cocky and I was going to get drunk. But I remember I did ask an old timer. He said, yeah, but you're good. Little did I know, when I was 4.5 years sober, I started going into a depression that I've never been in before in my life. It lasted for about a little over 2 years. And I'm not being poetic. I'm not trying to be a badass. But I didn't experience a day of joy for 2 years. Funny this morning at the group in Dixon, we kind of got on the topic of O'Doul. Talking about marijuana without drinking. My logic is, I wouldn't snort baby laxatives or vitamin B and thinking it's cocaine. And I wouldn't smoke paprika or whatever and thinking it's marijuana. Why would I want to drink O'Doul thinking it's booze? Because it ain't going to do a damn thing for me. I wouldn't shoot food coloring to pretend it's heroin. You know, I mean, that's the logic. I mean, why would you buy something that's not going to do... I remember there was a thing in the Chronicle a couple of years back that they had to develop a pill for alcoholics where you wouldn't feel the effects of the alcohol. I wouldn't drink.
I wouldn't drink if it didn't do anything for me. Why would I drink that crap? I never liked the taste of any of it. It's terrible, especially the hard stuff. Whiskey, gin, but I love what it did for me. You know, I love what it did for me. The lady who says she drinks those duels and it works fine for her, you know, that, you know, there's a controversy in AA, and I just said, you know, I shared with her, and I want to share with you, you know, because I don't know, I didn't know exactly what to say with her about that. I says, you know, when I was 7 years sober, I was putting guns in my mouth. So when I was 9 years sober, I got arrested. I said, I'm glad I wasn't doing no duels to stay sober. I don't thank you very much. That's all I could tell her. You know, she kind of looked at me with her mouth open, like, I think she heard that. Because I'll share this with you too. That was before I asked. I went from 6 months sober till I was a little over 4 years sober without a sponsor. Home, we moved from down the Bay Area to six. Home from the grocery store, we were having a little housewarming party, and 10 or 11 in the morning, and she put the grocery bags down, like six or seven of them. She came over to me, put her hands on my shoulder. And it was just, you know, I heard that, kind of hopefully like Linda heard, not this Linda, this Lady O'Doul Linda, in the meeting day. I heard that. I'm going, that wasn't right. You know, there's an intense warning in there somewhere. Like, it wasn't like the history of the dry diggings group. There was, I heard the middle part. It was like, and in 1963, we moved to 14th A Street. Ooh, 14th A Street. Hard work. A lot of hard work went into that. And that's when I asked Art to be my sponsor. That afternoon, I went up to him and kind of told him what was going on, and he said, that wasn't enough to keep me sober. Wasn't enough to keep me from putting guns in my mouth 2 years later. What I thought was my problem, the reason I was putting my guns in my mouth, was the very person who did a crisis. I'll tell you right now, if you have thoughts of killing yourself, it's not a normal thought. It's like three psychiatrists to figure that one out. And what I did, I shared with you, I surrendered to alcohol on February 17th, 1988. Remember, I'm running out of time, and I got to try to condense what I heard things. You come around here a lot, you're going to hear a lot. And I remember hearing things like, between 5 and 10 years, you'll face your spirit. You know? And there was this guy named Uncle Bobby from Sacramento, and he was 42 years sober. Never knew him. I mean, it was just like, hey, Uncle Bobby, 42 years sober. Involved around when he was. I remember there was a conference in Sacramento. No, it was Concord. And there was Uncle Bobby. Ran up to him, Uncle Bobby, when was the worst time of your recovery? And I thought he'd give me another jewel. Well, kid, between 5 and 10 years, he goes, it's 38th year. And I was like, you know, kind of like Linda putting her hand on my shoulders. It's like, not what I needed to hear. Exactly what I needed to hear, because it was the year his wife died and three members of Alcoholics Anonymous had been sober. Thought there'd be a point. What happened? I was maybe 6 or 7 years sober then, and what happened when Lenny did that crisis intervention? They took away my bullets. I wasn't going to give them my guns. And you can always go buy them. Surrendered to Alcoholics Anonymous. I surrendered to alcohol, but I didn't. And I believed in God, but I didn't trust God. It happened at 7 years. I look at it when the students are 80, the master will. I'm going to have to wrap it up a bit. I had enough to go to work that morning. It was a Thursday morning. And I had a profound sense that I was going to die that day. Strong, intense feeling. It took me a couple of years to realize it didn't scare me. I didn't think about it then. I wasn't like, hey, I'm not afraid. It was 2 years removed to go, wow, I was never afraid that whole day. I was going to go in and tell Linda that, you know, hey, I'm dying today. And she was like 4:30 in the morning. I thought there are some social skills to return. That wouldn't be a good idea to do. So I just went in. A lot of my religion, a lot of my philosophical beliefs around Native American culture. And I thought, you know, the hoop's closed with everybody in my life. I'd just go and kiss her goodbye, and that hoop would be closed. Let her know that I love her. And I'd walk out the door, and I was comfortable with that. And I never thought consciously about it. And to condense that up, I got a phone call from my parents. When I hung up the phone from that first conversation, I told myself, Michelle's dying today. I thought it was me. I never had that vision before or since. Wish I could know when things are coming. I knew pretty much the minute my sister died. I left work. And think, you know, my work's a wonderful place. They just said, you go do what you got to do. I vowed to myself that I'd never let another man or woman, alcoholic, I don't care, man or woman, cross my path. They want to know about the disease, I'll tell them. I don't know where that vision came from, where that voice came from, where that intuitive gut feeling. Walking, I mean, any time adversity in life shows up and wants a mature adult response, and there you are in your fuzzy slippers and your robe in the morning, nowhere to go. I don't have to go make sure I got no duels. I don't have to make sure I've got any marijuana or cocaine. About it, because that's the arrogance of the alcoholic. I know I just half the Dixon Police Department. Actually, I think it was all the Dixon Police Department following me home. I got arrested on my front lawn at 9 years sober. For 4 months, I was living at my mom's. 4 months of intense life, a fourth step, working the first three steps, ran around telling everybody what she did to me, what happened to me. They took my gun, goddammit. I was more worried about realized that, damn it, the state of California didn't like it. Hard. It's not hard. It's not easy to get down on your knees and apologize. You know, and I had to watch that. There was nothing I could do for that dog. Never over. I've gotten comfortable with it never being over. Comfortable being in my own skin. I've gotten comfortable with my God. I'll wrap it up simply with this. One of my favorite sayings is the Greek fisherman's proverb.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.